This is Betty Smith, March 18th, 1989. Heroic Path of the Feminine, Tape 2 of 3.
I let Argus pass forever. Now it is great Hermes, guide of souls, whom I choose as shepherd. Hermes smiled, his eyes softening for the first time. Perhaps you should know, he said, that I am shepherd of the unexpected, dealing in night deeds in pockets of the impenetrable dark. Yet I serve the circle of the gods. It is enough that you are close to the heart of Zeus. She smiled with her new confidence. So Hermes went aside, and he laid down his rod and sat upon a large stone, and he took out his flute and began to play a lazy, leisurely air in low register. Argus's sight had turned now on Hermes, all 100 eyes. They were full on the handsome shepherd. The music was the music of droning insects, half-drugged in the siesta of a summer's afternoon. The flute sounds were sweet and drowsy, like honey dripping slowly from a comb. First a few eyes of Argus closed, and then a dozen at a time. And he began to breathe heavily. Now only two eyes of the monstrous guard were still open, and they were glazed with torpor. Hermes caused the flute to descend slowly the steps to Hades. And as he did so, Argus's 99th and 100th eyes closed, and he was fast asleep. And then Hermes arose stealthily and drew forth the ancient adamantine sickle from his voluminous cloak, and Io saw only a blinding flash of light up on the air, and Argus's head rolled from his body. At the same moment, Hermes cried out, "Let no one look with so much sight on that which Zeus loves. Rot here." Adamantine. It's the hardest substance that's known, adamantine, which is a kind of stone, I think. Originally belonged to Cronos and then Zeus, Hermes. Io, dazed and silent, stood with her back to the death scene. Hermes turned her about to face him fully and said, "Io, stir yourself. Look at me. The music was not for you. Hear me, for I am here with you as the voice of Zeus himself. Get away from this meadow at once, lest Hera discover your freedom. Go, I tell you. I must go into the night? Yes, I'm afraid so. Are you fearful? I am. Most of all, I'm afraid that if I wander, Zeus will not be able to find me. I assure you that he will find you again. His love will be with you, Io. Did he say so?" Those were his very words. "The love of my invisible bridegroom. Where shall I go, Hermes? You are to wander for some time. For once conceived, the seed of Zeus must journey far upon a hidden root until it ripens and bursts forth to earth. You forget that I'm not a plowed field, but a woman," she said. "Soul maiden of Zeus and Hera, you are both." "But Hermes, must I wander? Such solitude is harsh." "It is true that you will be solitary as you wander, and it won't be easy or comfortable. Yet believe me, gods will be your companions. Never fear." She reflected on Hermes' gentle words, and then a slow smile touched her beautiful face. As to the great brown eyes, the light returned, and she turned and walked away down the plain of Argolis. So there begins the great journey of Io. All right. Now, as we take our break, and I thought, let's see, how many are there of us? Now, these are questions that are just for your pondering. If you care to, when you come back in after pondering it, to speak to it, there will be time for you to do that. But no one is going to call on you, or we're not going around the circle or anything of that sort. But we do need to take a number. Would you, without speaking though, take a number from 1 to 15? I know there are more than that. Some will have the same statement, you understand, because I only have 15 statements. Just choose a number and stay with it, if you will. Got your number? And then I will read the statements and call the numbers of each one. And you see if that particular statement speaks to you or what. This was particularly about the whole, this is the whole fertilizing condition. This is the intersection. This is the Zeus Io love. Number one, this white cowskin robe that covers the whole of me announces, hail to Io, the everlasting maiden. The white cowskin robe that covers me announces, hail to Io, the everlasting maiden. Two, if I dare to ramble in the meadow alone, perhaps a god will come to me. If I dare to ramble in the meadow alone, perhaps a god will come to me. And the third one, oh, what is it to walk on all four legs? Am I the four-cornered earth of old? What is it to walk on all four legs? Am I the four-cornered earth of old? And number four, under the cowskin, I have no voice, no speech. How is this deep silence that holds me captive? Under the cowskin, I have no voice, no speech. How is this deep silence that holds me captive? Now, there is a sense in which she has no human speech, even though she's been speaking in the dialogues. And number five, Zeus, you are the heavenly spirit. How can it be that I must carry your love as the earthbound cow? Oh, Zeus, you are the heavenly spirit. Why must I carry you as the earth-born cow? Carry your spirit, your love. Number six, how low and ordinary and unspeaking is the cow's existence? How low and ordinary the cow's existence. Yet somehow a voice says, you shall be queen. You shall be queen. Now that's speaking to the soul. That's speaking to the inner self, the inner one. And number seven, the great meadow draws me like a magnet. The great meadow draws me like a magnet. How will it be if gods wander there? How will it be if gods wander there? And eight, I have found Zeus in the meadow. A threshold is crossed. I have found Zeus in the meadow. A threshold is crossed. And number 9, within the cow, I walk in the way of the great nurturing goddess. Within the cow, I walk in the way of the great nurturing goddess. And 10, now I shall graze in the far pastures. I won't repeat that. And number 11, shall I leave the temple service that everybody approves of for the mysterious love of a god? Shall I leave the temple service everybody approves of for the love of a god? Number 12, O Zeus, love has opened broad pastures in which I am become the wanderer. Love has opened broad pastures in which I am the wanderer. And 13, O cloud, I sense that you are a holy blessing descended upon me. And number 14, this sounds more modern. Ah, my intellect rest does not see, does not judge, while I delight in being, and love covers me like a cloud, like a holy cloud. My intellect rest does not see, does not judge, while I delight in being. That's underlying, being. And while love covers me like a holy cloud. And the last one, 15. On this strange solitary journey, how am I to tell whether Zeus loves me faithfully or abandons me altogether? On this strange solitary journey, how am I to tell whether Zeus loves me faithfully or abandons me altogether?
There is a 15-minute Saturday afternoon break. Betty resumes then at approximately revolution 150.
Right. Just as the cloud contains the divine aspect in the union of Io and Zeus. Yes, it's just a quotation here. We were just getting a head start with a quotation. From the Iliad. A description of the marriage of Zeus and Hera. They lay in flowers and were held off the ground, covered by a beautiful golden cloud. This was Mount Ida.
Ida, as I say.
Thank you very much. And and another quotation, the Egyptian king Menkenre, and I'm sorry, I don't remember which dynasty he was, but way, way back there, had his daughter buried in a coffin that was a gilded cow. I don't mean it was a real cow, but it was a wooden coffin covered with gold in the shape of a cow to guarantee her rebirth. Now, there's a strong image connection, archetypal connection to this myth, because we have an incubation in the California myth, do we not? And the ancient Egyptian girl was, who could have had any kind of coffin, was buried by her father in the golden cow so that she would be reborn, because they knew the great generative goddess had the cow form. Okay. Now, all right. Do you, this should be a time for you to speak, to amplify any of the statements that fell to you, if it happened to speak to you, I think so, the gulf of the cow, Bosphorus, and goes as far as part of Russia, up by southern Russia, and then drops down and eventually comes to Egypt. So it's an enormous journey of a symbol of the individuation, or the soul journey, let's say the soul journey aspect. Maybe we weren't ready to individuate in that era, that time, that epoch, but enormous soul journey time. And tomorrow there will be the two great oracles. I'd like to read you something that Rilke, the poet Rilke, Rainer Maria Rilke, says about wandering. A woman had written him who was a good friend, and at that time I think he was living in Russia. And she said, "Do come home." At that time, let's see, he was born in Czechoslovakia. I think Germany was... He spent time in Germany and France. I'm not sure which country she considered home. "But do come home and take a house that is your own and stay and write. And do not be so lonely." He was incidentally very poor and separated a long time from his wife just for reasons... they had to be in two different places to make a living for a time. So this is the letter he wrote her, and I think it shows a lot about the basic motif of wandering. As she had said in her letter, "About me in tangible form stands all that I have." She was rejoicing in her house and her grounds. He says, "About you in tangible form stands all that is yours. My surroundings," he said, "are not placed about me. Far away on distant paths, I have seen the cities in which I dwell. And the gardens that rustle over me are many rivers away from me. Churches that stand by the rolling stream ring out to me morning and evening with their great sounding bells, and songs of blind men and children move about me like lost spirits and touch my cheeks and my hair. Such is my landscape, dear friend, and I may not desire to supplant these surroundings, which are like fragrance and sound about me. Do you understand that it is an infidelity if I behave as though I had found hearth and home already fully realized elsewhere? As yet, I may have no little house. I may not yet dwell. Wandering and waiting is mine." Wandering and waiting is mine. And there was another part of that letter. This was in the correspondence of Rilke. In the same letter, he said, "Every home has a good and warm influence, like every mother. Only I must seek my mother, mustn't I?" So he hasn't found his home. He must not. It would be infidelity, he said. Which means what? What's another word? What? Yes. Unfaithfulness. Not staying true to something. And it would be unfaithful and not... To claim, well, yes, this is my home now. I can make do here. I can make this my hearth and home. He said, I may not yet dwell. And one of the last motifs we will deal with in the myth of Io is dwelling. And I believe that is the I don't want to use the word goal. Having said goal was a conventional hero word. But I believe that's the end, the fruition of the feminine journey, of the soul journey, is to dwell. To dwell. To be at home. To be in one's own place. To be with what is one's own. So in the end, that brings in Hestia, doesn't it? I don't do so in this treatment, but that is that. So that is what she is doing now. She is wandering, and she must be experiencing abandonment. Also, just a word about the threshold crossing. The immense threshold crossing, I suppose, is when she is the bride of Zeus. But then there's a very important threshold, don't you feel so, when she gives up Argus and takes Hermes as the guide of souls. You felt it so viscerally when this happens. And I just want to say a thing or two. Often in people's faces, one reads the uncrossed threshold. One tends to draw away from such a person, not knowing why always. It's as though some natural developmental life stage threshold is ignored or its nature distorted. Or a crucial unseen inner threshold is not responded to. I don't know that we respond so quickly about the inner threshold of another. But I think we often get a sense of people when it's a more obvious developmental, outwardly developmental threshold that's not crossed, such as young womanhood to older womanhood, or boy to man and father. I think we often draw back somehow. A woman of mature years may seem to be saying in her actions and manner, I'm not woman, I'm the same girl I've always been. There's a truth in it, but something feels distorted somewhere. More often, she seems to be saying, this is a hypothetical woman, I'm not woman, I'm an everybody. And today, when women will say, often will say, I'm a nobody. It always distresses me when I hear that. But it often translates, I think, into when a woman says, I'm a nobody, she means I've been an everybody and it doesn't work anymore. That is, and everybody is too anonymous, okay? Each has her uniqueness. Each person has a uniqueness. And just a little bit there on the uncrossed threshold. Hermes, as a god, was always present at gateways. And he was even called the god of the door pin. The gate pin that makes a complete 360 degree, I think, turn. I'm not very mechanical in this. And he would be in the bedchamber or at the entrance to the bedchamber because he was the god who brought sleep and who brought wakefulness. So he's also very concerned with dreams, bringing dreams. And so he's the god of entrances and exits. And is that therefore an extremely important threshold god? His reputation as trickster I believe, refers to the actions to get a movement underway. You think so, maybe? Get something going that's in the movement of what we call the self, right? He doesn't seem to ever trick a soul on the path. He may trick a soul to get him on the path or something, but he is a reliable guide of souls. Yes?
When you described him when he first came into the story, he was wearing a three-pointed hat.
Yes.
The traveler's hat.
The traveler's hat.
What I thought of immediately was the fool. The tarot cards, the fool wears the hat with a bundle on. And of course, the fool was a trickster.
Oh,
and
yes.
He's got this bag of tricks. It's forever.
Oh, yes. That's a good connection.
He's also walking off the cliff.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
That's pretty much the way it works. See, for me as a man, I follow the woman.
Uh-huh.
And she's the trickster. Because I don't understand what a woman does, how she does it.
Uh-huh.
But I have to put my complete faith in her. I was a number nine, just like this woman under here.
Uh-huh.
But that meant a lot to me.
You were number nine? What did it say?
To follow the way of nurturing a mother.
Oh, yeah, I see.
And she's a trickster.
And of course, many ancient writers felt Aphrodite in the trickster camp, oftentimes too.
The two principal gods of war have been Hermes and Aphrodite.
Uh huh.
Now I think immediately from Aphrodite. You know,
yes. They had a child, too.
Yeah.
Yes, right. Right. I wouldn't say we've only had two main gods. We've also had Zeus.
Yeah, but he's sort of in the vapor on the back.
Yes, he's kind of cloudy. Right.
What do you think it means, her choosing, in choosing Hermes, she's kind of choosing to go with Zeus, that Hermes is Zeus's agent.
Yes.
As opposed to an over and above Hera, Artemis is Hera's agent.
Oh, I see.
What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm really asking,
mm-hmm.
I don't,
mm-hmm.
I can't figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone have a feeling about that?
Didn't she also choose Zeus as a hero when she wanted to die? As opposed to her duty?
Yeah, that's true.
Yes.
So it's the same choice made again, with a little more consciousness, a little more maturity.
Well,
yes.
She's learning more about her about him, too.
Yes.
Is that how Hermes is there, that she needs to get her own masculine?
The Hermes is, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And she's been victimized also with the tether. I mean, she's been victimized by Argos. Into this very complaining, and she's been shook. She's really shaken up. And I had other dialogues I didn't bring, but in which she shows her doubt that's raised about the love affair with Zeus. And so she moves back to affirm that relationship to Zeus. Yeah, she does seem to. And Hermes was such a welcome figure, always in Greek mythology. No one could resist him. And he had as much persuasion as Aphrodite does, except his was through words and action. Aphrodite's was more magical. Well, I think we're going to have to draw to a close. And tomorrow we have another... demon. We've gotten rid of Argus, but we We have the gadfly that always stings on the rump. Stings on the rump. The gadfly.
This ends the Saturday afternoon session at about 4 o'clock. The Sunday morning session at 10 begins at approximately revolution number 392.
One thing to add is if you do get these announcements, except for the Jungian societies and clubs, which are usually open numbered, I mean, the Poesis seminars, the ones that are entitled Poesis, are my own seminars, and they are quite limited in number, usually not more than 20 people, and quite often I limit it to 15. Participants. Those are usually the residential seminars at Lake Arrowhead, California, and Santa Barbara, and Malibu. For the person who asked, cell quote about reflection is an essential part of life, and actually helps us to get from one level to another, and is a recuperative mode of being. That is found in Gabriel Marcel's book. His two-volume work is The Mystery of Being. The Mystery of Being. It's volume 1, page 101. I couldn't find the reference yesterday. Afterwards. Was there any other... a question, or that we begin with, or the oracles today in time. There's a great deal that in this next stage of EOS that is really experienced, the wandering state. The wonder. This is very different, as we said, from playing or rambling in the meadow. It may have episodes of that, but wandering in itself and also being in exile. These two things come together for Io, the wanderer and the exile. She is, as it were, cast out from her former life, cast out from her former objective self, the priestess, acknowledged by all, and those who nod each day and give her recognition and say, yes, you're doing it well, and things are good. This is past for her. She's an exile from that life. There is no scene, by the way, in the actual myth in which Hera cast her out. But it's obvious that she has to go. She's no longer a virgin, which is required for the young priestess. She has been loved by the invisible lover, the god Zeus, the cloud lover. And so she goes on her way. And the one who breaks the tether is who? Who breaks the tether? Hermes breaks the tether that would still bind her in a negative kind of interval that could go on forever. He can bind her in a place where she's in prison, she's under the judgment, negative judgment of the temple, negative judgment of the former life, negative side of that tradition, and can be in a bitter place of complaint, I'm a victim, I didn't ask for this. Nobody understands me. It shouldn't have happened to me. Yes?
Gentleman brought up the question yesterday, why she rejected Hera and accepted Zeus and took Hades.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And I just thought of what there might be a rationale. In my experience,
okay.
In my experience,
and It's also important at such a time, I think, of turning against an earlier stage or an earlier epic. In fact, I think this is what Hermes partly meant, perhaps, in giving her the choice between Argus and himself, is she had to give up the complaints, finally. And she, which in effect means that, she also has to give up the former stage at some point as negative. But sometimes that takes a while. Maybe that takes another 10 or 15 years. But I hope not. I hope not that long to stop complaining. I don't want to listen. but it has to do with the fact that her path, and I take it from your story too, that the path is leading on to a creative kind of evolution of the self. And so the temple is darkened for a time. My own sense of the entire myth is, as I'm only getting to the last part in my work outside the seminar, but is that eventually she becomes a kind of priestess of Hera again. I mean, she is a priestess of Hera. She is a carrier of the great goddess. But she has to blacken that now for a period of time. And she doesn't understand it. I mean, she's only had it outwardly and superficially. But eventually, I think she comes as a very much like an image of Hera later, in the best sense of the flowering Hera. Hera was the flowering one. That was one of her supreme titles. We, as I say, we have her under such bad press, as only when she's raging or jealous, that we don't see what a full goddess she was in archaic times. And she was called Anthea, the flowering one. So Io comes to a similar kind of flowering, but you're right. Right now, it's black. Everything Argos and behind is black. And Argus, A-R-G-U-S, the monstrous shepherd, emphasizes the blackness, and she finally has to get away from that evaluation in order to move. He means well. She almost got caught. Because she got caught in it, yes. Her says, and he was writing this, I don't know, 40 years ago, that we have so developed the spectator in ourselves, the Argus, and he spends a great deal of his work. He's a contemporary, I mean, 20th century existentialist. He's not alive now. So a great deal of his work developing the participant as the, how does he say? He remembers the old European peasant as belonging to the land. He said, as the peasant, as the land is in the peasant, and the peasant is in the land. In that manner, we must develop the way we participate in being. And he talks a great deal about the act of welcoming the doorway, the gateway. I'm adding the image of gateway, but to welcome what happens and not to try to be the universal observer. We again have to take responsibility for the individuality of what we see and feel and know. And we are the presentation of being in our times. The psyche is our individual psyches are the presentation of being, and the spectator pulls us so outward, and it loses the soul level. I think that's why we need Io so much, and it's why we need these soul maiden myths to remind us that there is another level going on. This isn't just a cute story. This is it is another level going on. And I appreciate your relationship to it in various ways. Looking more closely, at a state of abandonment. It goes beyond this one specific experience. Say, you know, one can say, well, my spouse or my lover abandoned me, or my parents or this particular parent abandoned me in some important manner. We have those experiences. But looking more closely at abandonment itself, it is an archetypal experience. And it's more than a biographical fact. It's more pervasive. It comes in the inner journey. It comes in the soul journey, the whole experience of abandonment. And it alters one's being. So in other words, we're not going to get away from it. If we thought we were so special because we were the abandoned one, it is part of the soul journey if one takes it as that interior journey, that interior path, instead of staying in the Argus place of complaining and just feeling tethered to the facts of one's life. Now, I don't mean to speak lightly of being... Sometimes it takes us years to get out of that victim place. But the abandonment is an existential condition. It has a long, sustained, emotional, and visceral cord in it. Yes. Oh, once again. It has, this is abandonment as an existential condition. It has a long, sustained, emotional, and visceral cord in it. And when it happens to you, I mean, it's got you right down into the center. And an eel passes through this condition. In her wandering, she passes through the abandonment. Now, in the myth of Psyche, she passes... When does her abandonment begin? Do you recall? Remember the myth of Psyche? But when
after
she looks,
she sees
after she sees Eros, after she makes him visible, as it were, or whatever.
She was abandoned earlier also, and she was abandoned on the...
Yes, to begin that journey. To begin that journey. Uh-huh. Yes. Well, to undergo her initiation from the crag into the realm, that the Aphrodite initiation into that realm. That lower realm, as it was called. Yeah. But the long abandonment and wandering, when it came together, was after she looked at Eros. And in the myth of Ariadne, she is abandoned. It's probably the supreme mythological image in women's minds, especially women, is Ariadne being left by Theseus on the Isle of Naxos. You know, I'm always so aware when I go to Naxos that you can only get there by ship. No planes in. And it's only really good. If the ferries sail. And I've always been so aware of that archetype of abandonment that kind of haunts the island, even though it's beginning to change now and get more modern. And twice I have taken... groups there, the mythology tour groups. And the first time, part of the group decided, without any hostility, oh, we're going to another island for a few days. And they left us. And we all of those of us who stayed behind, felt really abandoned. But we had a wonderful seminar without them. And they came back and they'd had a good time. They had a terrible sea journey. But and we all said, all right. But abandonment. And there was an old boat abandoned on the beach near the hotel. Let's see. The next time I took a group there, part of the group said, this doesn't always happen, by the way, because I don't always go to Naxos. I don't dare go to Naxos. Part of the group said... well, you know, we'd rather be on the beach. So would you mind if some of us went down there to that hotel? And I said, well, as long as we come together for seminar, I don't mind. Half of the group left their rooms, paid again, and went to a hotel, a little pension on the beach. And it was just only in retrospect that I realized, yes, there always seems to be some kind of strange exodus and abandonment when we come to Naxos. And the third time, there really was a third time, the woman of our pension came rushing down, looking in every little taverna on the beach, looking for my assistant and myself, to tell us, oh, your ship isn't coming. It's broken down, your ship isn't coming, and you either have to leave tomorrow or you have to wait 5 days. And so we had to abandon our plans to go inland, and we left the next day on a different ship. And incidentally, those things have only happened on that island. Well, so much for taking an archetype so strongly with you. And that's neither here nor there, but... this is very much recorded in one's feeling life, this individual experience of abandonment. One is separated out, and that is painful. When you read Edinger's work in alchemy and Jung's psychology of alchemy, you read all about the separatio, don't you? And it sounds so good on paper. But when you're separated out, it can feel, this dark separating out can feel very solitary and very much a victim. But it's a very important inner happening, and there's a sense of loss with it and often emptiness. Very curiously, among many writers, especially male writers, I think it's to the point, the nature of the feminine has been described as emptiness. Now, women don't like this description. But it's not talking about a woman's head. It's not talking about... but the nature is vessel-like, right? And the dream we told yesterday of the woman artist was the priestly figure came with the clay jar, the empty clay jar. Here was the container of the journey. So the soul is ultimately like a clay jar and has this aspect of emptiness. So Io is being prepared. She's being emptied. She's being hollowed out, as it were. And that's not always the most pleasant thing. And she undergoes the cow skin in order to have that happen. There's an interesting manuscript from the Nag Hammadi Library, the ones that were found on the bank of the Nile, you know, 30 years ago or whenever it was. They come from the 4th century. They were written down in the 4th century A.D., already a long oral tradition, Christian tradition, written in a Greek Orthodox monastery, which had Gnostic leanings. And then apparently these... codices had to be hidden, were hidden in the jars, and the shepherds found them after many years. But in one of these, which is a document on the soul, the title is... I can't remember the specific title. It's the only one in the Nag Hammadi group that bears the soul in the title. The exegesis of the soul, I think, or something like that. It tells the story of the soul as a woman coming into the world, and she completely forgets who her true lover is. This is a little different way to speak of invisible lover. She forgets his face. She forgets who he is. She's forgotten his name. It's another way of talking about invisibility, but from another sense. And she goes from lover to lover and in and out of all kinds of relationships. And until her life is in chaos, and she cries out to the Lord God. This is a Christian work. This cries out to the Lord God, and he hears her, and suddenly she realizes she has worn her womb on the outside of her body instead of on the inside. Now, what an image that is. And it's something connected to the Argus, the spectator. We're totally exposed. There's no place to hide the treasure. There's no place to hide the new birth. She wore the... It's strangely contemporary in tone. And then she prepares for her heavenly bridegroom. She remembers then who her true bridegroom was. And the marriage is prepared and consummated, and it's almost like the Song of Ecclesiastes in its beauty. But then her womb returns to the inside. So it's a very, very curious thing. We need to restore our inner power of generation. And that's what's happening with Io. Io is under something. She is kind of... she's doubly incubated, isn't she? She's inside the cow, and then she carries her own interior life within that. I think that's what Jungian analysis is all about, is preparing the inner space in a sound and healthful way, so that you have space to be in, to be again, in a true kind of existence, to live a generative life. We have so much emphasis on living creatively, and sometimes in our emphasis, we emphasize the product, what comes out, what I can show, what I can publish, what I can show, what I can present. The generative life has a more interior concern to it. It also is creative, but it has a much more interior point of view. Something comes out, grows out of the existing life. Okay. In this wandering, it's not necessary to be useful anymore. Io, this is a practical side of it. Io doesn't have to be useful. She's not answerable on the schedule that's posted in the temple door, and there's no time clock. She is in herself in some way. So, does that feel free or bound to you? That's what you have to ask yourself. Whether that makes you feel free or bound to be wandering. Both. Mm-hmm. It's important how you answer that. There's something later that Prometheus says about freedom, too much freedom, that speaks to this point, but we're not there yet. Okay. Now, there's an encounter of Io with the gadfly. And I'd like to read the dialogue if I could. And edit as I read. I didn't read that, did I? No, not the gadfly. No. She's been wandering from one pasture to another. And at last, she exhausted, she sinks down under a fig tree, a wild fig tree. At once, she experiences a piercing, burning pain on her exposed rump. There's something still exposed there, in spite of it being an incubation. And she says, "Oh, what's happening to me now? First it was the raw neck I suffered from my tethering." She turned her head backwards to look and said, "Why, it's a gadfly. The biggest I've ever seen. Look how the huge black eyes regard me, the wings keeping time to some unseen breath. And now he cocks his head as if he hears my thoughts. How very much like an upright man this creature is. Black creature, why do you attack me?" "Go on," he said. "It's only a little bite I took." "Only a little bite," he says. "Look, why are you so hostile towards me?" "I'm not hostile. I'm hungry." "Well, it amounts to the same, although I suppose it is different. Couldn't you have said, 'By your leave, I'll have a small bite,' something like that?" "No, I couldn't have, and I wouldn't have." "Then you are my enemy, you see." "I know. If you would feed me, I wouldn't be your enemy." "Why feed on me?" And her anger flared. "You've had a bite, so go somewhere else. Please go. It isn't time for me to leave just yet." And he began to buzz about thoughtfully, each time landing on a new piece of her flesh. "Oh, why does trouble hound me like this? How I dread another bite. First it was the cloud and arrows of Eros, although I never saw them. And then it was the hundred-eyed guard. And next came the loss of my woman form in the cowhide." And she began to cry. "Shall I tell you something?" he said. "Yes. It was all your fault." He was quietly regarding her now, his eyes relentless in their stare. She said, "You're no different from Argus accusing me. Only listen. I bite, but I do not accuse. I only tell you a fact, however unpleasant. What has happened in Argos Meadow is your own doing." If only in all the world I could find a little compassion. "My fact will just have to do," he said. "Why don't you hold up your head and look at me?" And with this he left the rear position, perched on a fallen branch, and faced Io, very close to her nose. "There, that's better. It's my doing, you say. There's the real bite. The first bite was only to wake me up, wasn't it?" He nodded. "Try to hear me. I only went to the meadow to ramble, to be solitary, to be free of all my priestly duties, to enjoy the fragrant world of grasses and flowers. Somehow, you called out the gods." "You weren't listening, gadfly. I said that I was off duty from the gods, from my service to Hera." "Off duty from the gods, were you?" "Off duty from the gods? No one's ever admitted it before." "Io, that's when the gods really pay attention to you." "No, I didn't know. For once, you weren't asking for anything." "What? What should I ask for? The meadow gave me everything my heart desired." "I see it now. There you were, all sweet and dreamy and wildflowery, and along came Zeus, smelling the flowers. I shouldn't have resisted that myself. So you see, it was your doing. You found the meadow at its blooming best and lay down in it. Here came Zeus. He loves to ramble. And he couldn't help stumbling on the meadow with you in it. That's the whole thing in a drop of nectar. You waylaid Zeus. There must surely be a difference, Gadfly, between bringing about something and meaning to bring it about. I did not mean to attract Zeus. You didn't attract him on purpose. She shook her head. It doesn't matter, since mortal purpose is disposable anyhow, when a god has a purpose. Zeus had one when he saw you. There's something else, though, maiden. You desired great Zeus. It's written all over you like some unread text. Perhaps. Say about the bite. The bite. Whether it's an insect bite or what other kind of bite? Snake bite. And there were some famous bites. Orion the hunter was pursuing the daughters of Atlas, the Pleiades. When Mother Earth defended the Pleiades, the nymphs, and sent up an enormous scorpion. And remember, it bit him on the heel, I believe. Pretty sure, on the foot, and he died. And that was, feels like a punishment or a vengeance or an enormous interruption on the part of Earth Mother. The snake, actually, often we don't remember that part of the myth, but it was the snake, was it not, that bit Eurydice in the myth of Eurydice and Orpheus. And she dies and goes to the underworld. And had the snake not bitten Eurydice, Orpheus's love, to put it from Orpheus's standpoint for a moment, he would never have made his underworld journey. And you remember, he went to the underworld to bring her back. And from the ego point of view, that was not successful. From the ordinary point of view, he didn't get her out of the underworld. There's an expression that I've heard among analysts occasionally that goes like, has he been bitten yet? Or has she been bitten yet? We use that expression, don't we? Many people use it. Once bitten, one is kind of initiated, and one doesn't turn back. Something, this new energy comes up, as Bill says, and a new bonding of some kind happens. Something comes in. One is inseminated with something. So the gadfly bites Io, and the gadfly is sent by Hera, just as Argus was. I think in a way the gadfly is one of the most helpful figures that you can have for inner work, because he goes little by little. I mean, you get a bite at a time, and you suffer one of those hurts just one at a time, and have to deal with them. And it's an encounter every time. This is the second one, which is grief. Second encounter, last encounter with Gadfly. Io had been tediously climbing and descending one unmarked path after another, entering strange, vast pastures, trudging through mud of unknown stream banks, and so forth. Also, it's very rugged country that she was traveling in. As she goes northward, through Greece. The strain of her journey was upon her. She got bone weary, and she finally comes to a resting place, as she had before, and lies down, and in short time experiences the penetrating sting. And she knows this time, of course, who it is. Not just what it is, but who it is. Oh, gadfly, it's you again. Would that I had the knack of the fast tail swish. I suppose there must be some art in making it as a heifer. And at these words of Io's, gadfly withheld the stinger with which he was carefully taking aim at a particularly tender piece of heifer flesh. And he said, "Ah, so you honor me with human speech." I guess she didn't always. "You mean that that pleases you?" "Yes, it does. But I won't talk unless you are courteous to me." And she said, "How can you speak of courtesy? You've stung me at least 100 times. And he said, "Well, perhaps I never count, you see. I've got my work to do. I only do what is necessary." "Then tell me at once why it's necessary to sting me. Why, we couldn't have you getting distracted in first one meadow and then another, and then lingering by the pond for the whole afternoon, that sort of thing. No, we couldn't have it." Who is we? "Don't you know? Hera and I." "My beloved goddess, the one for whom I've been faithful priestess, it's difficult to believe that Hera has been persecuting me." "She's been looking after you all along with my help." "Look, gadfly, I thought I was cursed to be given the form of a white heifer and the wandering that followed. Yet I was at least consoled to think that I was free to go where I pleased," meaning outside the tether. "And now it appears that even that is not true." "If you're asking me the question, I can answer it okay." He began to buzz about thoughtfully. "Do stop buzzing about and tell me, please." "All right. You are not being punished, and you are as free as a human can be." "Can you explain that? I heard Hera say that you had to be protected, and that meant hidden from human eyes. This journey of yours is a hidden one, and you could get lost from it. Being a white cow's no punishment, none at all. Why, Hera herself sometimes goes as a white cow, you know. Everybody knows she has the big cow eyes. That's enough reason for Zeus to woo her. So you see, she's given you her favorite cover to go under. So as not to get lost, I mean. You speak of the heifer as though it were a kind of canopy to hide the soul under." "That's it, that's it. I knew you'd finally catch on. Something else I overheard Hera say. She said, 'Io, who is my favorite priestess of Argos, is very much like myself. Actually, she is half and half, half human and half Hera on earth.' Then she said to me, 'Follow her, guard her well, so that she does not lose the treasured two parts.' Thank you, gadfly. I believe I can resume my journey now." To develop, in my experience of the myth, a kind of duality now with Io, and maybe that was part of the expression of that, that there is something of the goddess that she carries. There is something of the divine that the soul carries, another way of saying it. There is a divine measure, a divine seed, however you want to put it, that is carried. And that constitutes part of her identity, not ego identity, but part of her identity. And she's Hera on earth, is the way it's put. And she is the cow maiden. She is Io herself, Io consciousness plus this goddess consciousness. Do you know? Do any of you know? Have any of you seen the tombstone of Jung? Do you remember the statement on there besides his forebears and his own? Do you remember the motif? I kind of think it's in Latin. I'm not sure, as I remember. I don't remember what that is. Heather. Is that right? Yes. It's a very lush spot in the graveyard. I was with Edith Sowall once in Kuznak, and we asked an old resident, could he tell us where the grave of C.G. Jung was? And he thought for a moment who that would be. It's not necessarily known locally. And he said, oh, you mean the old professor. And then he told us where to look in the graveyard. And he was revered as the final professor. So I guess part of his life was quite hidden in those times. But at any rate, I brought this up because on the tombstone, and it just came into my mind, is the statement, can anybody quote it? Something like, it honors both aspects, the duality of the human being. I don't think I can quote it quite. It's actually from St. Paul, I think. Something from the earthly man, the earthly life, from the heavenly man, a spirit. But that's the gist of it. You have earthly man and heavenly man. And both of those aspects are put side by side and equally valuable on the tombstone. The earthly side and the heavenly side. And in one of Jung's books, one of his popular books, actually, I believe it's The Undiscovered Self, he talks about the Greek twins, Cadmus and Castor and Pollux, Polydeuces in Greek. Yes, a Castor and Pollux. And one is mortal and one is immortal, and they remain inseparable. They kind of alternate their life. After the mortal one dies, they make a covenant so that the mortal one can come back, and half of the time they live in the underworld and half the time they live on earth. But they stay together, these two parts, these two brothers, these twins, inseparable, the mortal side and the immortal side. And Jung pays tribute to that as that is human existence in its fullest, are these two aspects. Well, I think in the feminine hero journey, that's where this is beginning to happen now, is that Io is becoming dual, which is part of the process of consciousness, and she is carrying the God aspect as well as her human consciousness. And within her human consciousness, the animal the closeness to the animal world. So, all of that. Also, it need not be entirely a metaphysical statement. I mean, I'm using that in a philosophical sense. It may need not be a description of one's being to come to the nothingness, as much as it can be a profound attitude. Through a profound attitude, one can empty or be hollow, and have that inner spaciousness. One needs inner spaciousness and for anything to happen. One doesn't need everything knocking around inside, crashing into each other. One doesn't need all the affects and ideas and notions and busyness and plans and all crashing into each other. One needs to hollow out and find a place that functions as the empty vessel. So that is part of the task. That was what the clay jar was about yesterday, I think, too. And it's amazing how fresh one's experience is after the hollowing out. That when one achieves is not the word, but when one is able to bring about the hollowed out place, which means the ego bows in a certain way. The ego isn't there with all it knows. It's quiet. I mean, the ego is quiet. It's not absent, for sure. There is such a freshness, there's such a directness to the experience of others and of being and what comes. So nothing is a good way to be, or empty as an existential condition. And the meadow is partly that. The meadow is an image of space. You have to find the inner meadow, this inner spaciousness. But it's a natural place, too. It's not a contrived space. It has to be close to where you feel good and comfortable with yourself. Relatively so. All right. It's almost time for our break. There is now. There's one more. A little interlude, and because so much of the wandering journey seems dark, there is an episode I wanted to read you. And it's between Io and Aphrodite. It's not recorded in the original Ovid account of the myth, but she has somewhere to be close to the love goddess and the love experience. And so it's the love experience is personified here as Aphrodite. And I'll read this before the break. Io had reached a pleasant vale this time that lay between the rocky hills, like a silken green shawl carelessly shed by Gaia upon the ground. Thick grasses abounded, and the brook ran, and it was just a very pleasant place. And she's speaking, and she says, "Perhaps it's not so bad after all. Just look at this place that my wandering has brought me to. Could this be the fabled Vale of Tempe, which the god Apollo is said to seek out for his idol? I wonder. No, I'm not in the region of Thessaly, where Apollo finds his dwelling place." And a voice said, "You speak of an idol." Yes, an idol. How good that word feels on the tongue. "And have you forgotten how to have an idol, Io?" "Strange question. This place stirs a memory that has entangling roots within me. The meadow. Can it be that you remember the meadow wherein you knew the love of the God? Oh, indeed, that is what is stirred by this veil that offers me its green shawl. Is it that you have forgotten how to? How to what? To be in the meadow, of course. To be in the meadow as a woman is in the meadow. For to be in the meadow is to be pathless for a measure of time, to be idle. To be pathless, to be idle. You are speaking to a wanderer and traveler. Is not the path all important then? The finding of it? The staying on it? I shouldn't have thought so, the voice said. And she laughed. The voice laughed spontaneously. That laugh seems to me like it lives in this extraordinary place. It's rather like the sound of the brook that muses on its own thoughts and is pleased. Whose is that laugh? I am Aphrodite, the voice said, without whom no dazzling cloud would ever have found its way to you to win you for its own. Nor would the meadow have drawn you so inexorably had it not been for my presence. All hail, my lady Aphrodite. I am surprised by Aphrodite. Perhaps you should know that I am the most surprising of all the gods. Even now I find that an odd indifference towards the path of my travels has come over me. I could stay here in this lovely vale forever, I think. Aphrodite laughed again. Forever is long and taxing for a mortal, even one who is deeply in love. I wonder if I am lost. You are more found than lost, Io. Believe me. So the idol becomes possible. That time that is unclocked, a time whose grace cloaks you with subtle riches. The idol is your power, Aphrodite, isn't it? For as I look shyly upon this place, it smiles at me so that I cease being a stranger. Everything surrounding us seems to beckon to me. My name is called. It's as if my name were called. Io, Io, play, play, play. See how I kick up my feet, which have been heavy. I throw back my head and let laughter course my long white throat. Yet again, I am so quiet as to be quite motionless. I am the stone rippled over by the waters, and the stone does not answer, for it is the ecstatic listener bathed in the ever-fresh current. Here there are no results to be observed. It is enough that I am round and shining and smooth under the hand of the waters. In this manner, Io enjoyed the wondrous presence of Aphrodite and came to know the golden time of the idol in which all cares and stress are forgotten. Time cannot be counted. And the grace of Earth Goddess herself abounds. And after some time, Io grew reflective and said, alas, can it be that I'm carried away like some sleeping nymph, quite out of touch with the real world? And Aphrodite spoke with some disdain now. You are like all humans. Though all the world depends on it, you cannot tell the difference between sleeping and waking. Oh, please do not leave, Goddess. Stay with me. You've given me a jolt, and I see that truly I am but awakening. Nor shall you come to a time when you shall say, I have been awakened. Always you, Io, shall be the awakening one, the awakening one. Remember this. It may be hard to remember a thing not understood. Perhaps so. Tell me, have you any desire in this place? Io hung her head. My desire returns. I do long for my lover to appear. Goddess, you have all power over matters of love. At the beginning of love, I am known to have full dominion. Not just at the beginning, surely. I stand at the gateway between two domains. This gateway is, of course, love itself. Passing through it, the one who loves knows a forgetfulness, a dimming of the domain left so recently behind. Ah, and then there's the delight of love itself to claim one. What if one should decide to turn around within this gateway and return? That's not possible, I fear. One is unalterably changed by love, Io. You shall never return to the maiden of Hera's temple. That priestess of Argos is seen no more. And she's profoundly afflicted by those words from hers. Oh, black night, I'm cut off from my goddess forever. Never shall I know Hera's gracious presence again. No, you misunderstand. Just a little bit more, that's all. You are still in Hera's service, and perhaps you always shall be. Hera does not abandon what is her own, to be sure. What I meant by the words, my words, is this. You have emerged on this side of the golden gateway of love and are greatly changed. Do not look so forlorn, Io. It is not as if I bore you bad news. See, listen, at this moment, two doves on the branch of the plane tree above began their low litany. And Io said, the doves are joyous and at peace in this vale. Then why is it you withhold yourself from my joy and peace, since it abounds here? And she complains, it's because she's abandoned and alone. Then she tells her that Zeus is not an easy spouse. Yet did you not choose him? And then Aphrodite tells her, surely the heart's most important choice is hidden from oneself. One's most important choice is hidden from oneself. And you drew him, she says, editing, you drew him because of the choice that slept within you. The sleeping choice is as strong as the hand of the fate. And then she says, I tell you, your destiny is as splendid as any, and were it not so, I should personally complain. Then onto the path, not exactly a path, but the wanderer's way, I would say. It's not so well defined as a path with markers and mileages. Wanderer's way. Just as we had to do that and go from pasture to pasture, always seeking, always questing. It's a questing time. And nothing is firm in reality in the wandering. There is a statement that Karenyi makes in his preface to his little monograph that he did on Hermes. He talks about the traveler, the true traveler or wanderer, not the tourist, but the true traveler or wanderer, as being volatilized, that his being is no longer firm. He has no place to dwell. He has no stance. One has no stance. It's one's being is kind of volatilized, as it were. So one is enormously vulnerable, and there is an openness that belongs to that existential condition of being a wanderer or in exile, especially the wanderer, and in exile more than the traveler. But now there is a movement as she goes. She also covers great geographical distance, always by just putting one foot in front of the other. That's the way she goes. One foot in front of the other. Very grounding way of movement. Hermes may have wings on his feet, but Io doesn't. Her guide can have a connection to the spirit, the spirit, but she still has an earthly path to go. And now she moves towards oracles. She moves towards Dodona. And I'd just like to say something in general about oracles in Greece. And we'll be approaching this afternoon. The great place of oracle in Greece, what do you know the name of it? Delphi. And Apollo. Apollo is the god of the oracle there, right? Before Apollo, it was G. Themis, the great earth goddess, and her daughter kind of fused in the oracle. In fact, it was a dream oracle before Apollo. Did you know that? It was a dream oracle before Apollo came. And it was an ecstatic oracle under Apollo, delivered by the priestess of Delphi. The Sibyl used to be a young woman, a virgin, because we always connect the soul maiden aspect to the bridge, to the god. But the Greeks were also very practical people, and having a virgin as priestess, living alone up on the mountain and near the temple, didn't work out so well. And so they started choosing a woman over 50, a woman who was alone but married. So I think, I don't know, a widow or living alone but married. Married woman over 50. But in any case, when she delivered the oracle, she delivers it on the tripod at Delphi, and she chews the laurel, or she may breathe vapors of burning laurel leaves. It's all in question, quite sure. And she drinks the sacred water from the spring Kasotis, and she reaches her state of unity or with the god, where she is a channel. She becomes empty. Now, this is not not something for all of us to do. I'm not recommending to go home and buy a tripod, anything like that. I think it's rather highly dangerous. But she was always a simple girl, a simple woman, uneducated woman, who was devoted to the god. And she was able to so get in touch with the god that he spoke through her. So it was considered the voice of Apollo coming through the priestess or the Sibyl. And some say she ranted, and they were syllables that could not be understood. This is called a mantic state. It's one of the three forms of madness in ancient Greece, but it's a healthy madness and a voluntary madness, to be seized by the spirit of Apollo and to be prophetic. And she would come forth with her prophecy. And priests, the male priest, did the verses in which they wrote it down and delivered it to the people. Always, usually quite practical questions were asked there. And great questions of state were asked. Also. Now, Io doesn't come to Apollo at Delphi, even though it's the leading oracle in Greece. She goes far into the world, far into the Pindus Mountains on the east, and not far of the Ionian Sea on the west, and into this little vale of tiny little valley among the hills, very isolated, which is Dodona. Dodona. It's the only place on earth that Zeus ever had an oracle. Zeus's oracle. And later I'll describe a little bit about it, what it was like. I had a curious experience in 1987 at Delphi. Had a question. I cannot now remember my question, but it was very important to me. And I just went and stood near the temple ruins, the high plateau, and in approximately the place where a French archaeologist once told me that the Sibyl went down those steps about there and had her tripod. So I stood there and I no sooner got to the spot than I felt a really sense of strong statement coming, which I took as an answer, but it was not an answer to the question I brought. This is what was strange. But immediately I inferred the question from the answer. And I knew that was the prior question. But I didn't know it till I got there. And the answer came to a question I had not asked. And talk about God's pushing aside mortal purposes. I don't mind telling you the answer. I don't think I could tell you precisely. I had a sense of what the question was from it. But I couldn't say it precisely. And it was a... The first part sounded very sad to me. The statement came, understanding is gone desolate. Grace and beauty are the path. That's all there was. And I understood that as in terms, not in our modern sense of grace, But the Graces were, as figures, immortal goddesses, were important at Delphi, and sometimes came there. They were the sense of, how would I say it? They have to do with abundance, and they give life a favorable presence. So if you were undertaking something in ancient times, very serious undertaking, you might well pray for the Graces to bless it. And the Graces brought a favorable sense of things. In that sense, they're very close to the hours. It's hard to distinguish them, which are seasons. So the Graces also have this sense of a context. They bring a context so that things work in the context. That's what I understood grace to mean, and it seems to abound in the ancient realm of Apollo. And beauty has to do with, in the Greek sense, not too much and not too little. Balance, right measure. Plato's dialogue asking, what is beauty? Deals with this. I think it's the Philebus, could be mistaken, but in his dialogue comes out with beauty is measure, just the right measure, not too much and not too little. And so there is a sense of fittingness. It precisely fits nature, or it precisely fits the situation. It precisely fits the image, or it precisely expresses. notion of perfection. Or if you come upon the image, for example, in mythology, you come upon the image that expresses the way it is in life, or the way this is in the psyche, or the way something is lived, then that fits. That's apt. That is beautiful. It's not ornamental. It's not an ornamental notion of beauty. And I think it was a direction-giving message. But curiously, so I just want to say, be prepared for getting an answer to a question you didn't ask. The answer I got, the statement I got as I stood there, was, understanding is gone desolate. And I knew it was talking about modern culture. Understanding is gone desolate. Grace and beauty are the path. Now, I wouldn't make a dogma of that or anything. I just, the first part felt very sad to me. Understanding is important to me. But there is an emphasis on something else, another element. And I felt as if what was being described was a collective phenomenon. Understanding is done. Some kind of collective phenomenon. Grace is, I would say, the essence of it in the ancient Greek sense was favorable presence. Favorable presence. The Gracers always accompanied Aphrodite. And sometimes they were in Hera's presence too. Hera had a very strong Aphrodite side. Favorable presence. But even at Olympia, in the competitions and the contests, they would pray to the Graces or make offerings to the Graces to bless the race, to bless the occasion.
Would that be a song of Amazing Grace? The same
famous.
It's more organic. I'm going to make about the oracle. I mean, not one last, but before we go to lunch, one last. But just one comment in passing on the Graces. It seems to me that the Graces answer the question, how is it? How is it in being? How is it with being? How is this experience? How is this thing we pass through? The understanding addresses more the question, what is it and why is it? Contemporary understanding, more collective understanding. And, you know, there's a place for that, but it's a different kind of a... One turns much more to the qualitative, the qualities of existence and the texture, the feeling, the texture, the sense of it. Yes?
When you were talking about the understanding...
You must listen well in order to approach an oracle. I think that makes sense, doesn't it? You don't go to lecture the oracle. you listen, and you've got to get your ears cleaned out and whatever to go there. And there is a kind of centrality of the question. It's very important to get with the central question, as apparently I did not do the prior question. And then one should not be overconfident or overbold in spirit in the presence of the oracle. When you walk into the museum at Piraeus, the port of Athens, there's a marvelous relief of Heracles and Apollo, kind of an archaic relief, it feels like, at least in its style. And what's Heracles got under his arm but the tripod? He's just stolen it, and he's going off with it because this is a great thing to have, and he can do it if anybody can do it. And he's got the tripod under his arm. But he thinks to look backwards. Something in Heracles says, better look where you've been. And he looks back towards Delphi, and Apollo is right behind and has laid his hand on the tripod to reclaim it. And I find that a very, very powerful image, a very, very powerful statement. And it has a lot of contemporary something in it. Contemporary desire, contemporary way of laying hold of gods and goddesses. And there's a line between claiming that there is a threshold to the god that one can stand before without groveling. There's a line between that and carrying off the god or carrying off the god's function. It's a no-no to carry off the tripod. But in myths, there's a time to look and a time not to look. And I thought about that aspect of this too. There's a time for Heracles to look backward and see where he's been. Because he's a pretty fast man. He acts pretty fast. So he probably should do a little more looking back. But and for Perseus, when he's about to slay the Medusa, for what however you feel about that, it's the orders of Athena, he must not look. He must look at the reflected image in the shield of Athena. He must not look. It's too much darkness that will swallow him. And so, you know, knowing the time to look and the time not to look is very important. But at an oracle, it's more listening. It's a listening and a waiting. So that's, we'll go to Dodona at, let's see, it's 20, very ancient place. It was the place of the goddess Dione, D-I-O-N-E.
Dione. In Greek. The delta in Greek is like a TH.
So it's Dione. It really means god or goddess in Scottish. Our word theo for god or theology comes from same root, Dione. The D is very soft like TH, but it's not as aspirated quite like TH. Dione was an early...
My apologies.
Sorry. That's okay. All right. We're on. Dione was possibly a goddess from Egypt. It's hard to be sure. It goes back, so far back. And she was served by two priestesses. And it really was quite certain that these two priestesses of Dione were from Egypt. And they were called the pigeons or the doves, kind of alternating words. I mean, birds are pretty close. The pigeons or the doves, because when they spoke, or at least this is a conjecture, that when they spoke or when they chanted, it sounded like pigeons cooing or doves cooing. Pigeons, yeah, pigeons or doves cooing. And so they were called the pigeons. that attended this goddess. So I presume, I don't know, all in all it feels like quite a gentle atmosphere where the goddess was there when she was there. She was there alone, with no consort, until Zeus came. She was the goddess of the oracle there. And Zeus came. I didn't bring that dialogue, but I have done one in which Zeus comes and wins Dione and shares the oracle then with her. But as we move more into late antiquity, or into the classical age rather, it's referred to as Zeus's oracle now, just as Apollo took over the oracle at Delphi. But this was a place of sacred marriage, one of the marriages of great marriages of Zeus and Dione. Zeus with his oracular feminine aspect. Zeus united with the wise one. He married one other wisdom figure, as a matter of fact. He did have some goddesses for wives. So Dione was one of them, and the other one was her name? Means wisdom of the gods. Not Sophia, but it means wisdom of the gods. And for some reason it slips my mind at the moment, but she indeed really was the mother of Athena. Metis, thank you. Metis was her name, and she was the mother of Athena. That is to say, she had she was carrying the pregnancy with Athena from Zeus when Zeus regressed, like his father Cronos and his grandfather Uranus, and swallowed Metis. First he persuaded her to be like a fly, and then he swallowed her, because it was prophesied that the offspring would somehow surpass himself. The offspring of Metis would surpass himself. And he was very frightened and swallowed Metis. And as you know, he carried the pregnancy himself, and she burst from his head. But we often forget that there was a pregnancy there in which Metis was involved. In any case, those were the two goddesses of wisdom that Zeus had married at different times, Dione, early goddesses, and Metis. So this is a sacred marriage place that Io comes to. Again, she's drawn by the sacred marriage archetype. Again, she's drawn to this place. There's a knowing here in this place. There is a logos here. And yet, here also are the sacred roots of her love relationship to Zeus. But this is the first time she's ever approached her invisible spouse as oracle. And I wonder what it is. Just consider this question. I wonder what it is to go through a period of loss, rejection, abandonment, wandering, all within the context of a great love, but especially the psyche love, and come to the place of its wisdom. She's returned to the spouse, but she's returned to him as wisdom giver. She's returned to her marriage as a source of knowledge, as a source of an answer, a logos that has not been formulated. An oracle can only be formed in the presence of the questioner. You don't go there and punch a button and it's already, you know, it's already canned. The oracle is a response of the god to the individual. And so she's approaching this place, the ego's in a much humbler place, if we think of Io as the woman, a much lower place, not demanding. Whatever her expectations have been over the period of this time of the journey, they must have been somewhat altered and honed down, her expectations, her demands on love, on her life. Something's been worked on. But I do think it takes a new openness to go to the oracle. There's a new quiet, a new listening. And it would have been no good to have come earlier, not until she's prepared to listen. Now, and I hope that doesn't sound over-obedient to you. It should be the wanting to listen that comes out of the desire nature, out of the desire nature, the longing nature. Not I ought to, want to, but I ought to. Not that kind of listening. But it's a very eager readiness, I think, that comes to the oracle. And somehow it feels to me as if her wandering changes at this point. Do you think so? I mean, do you just wander into an oracle? Feel to you as if there might be a shift, purpose forming, even though perhaps not known to the ego. And what is the step? Let me put this another way. What is this step of moving not out of her eros bondage, of being really bound to the love, although she is bound to it, not moving only out of that, but somehow seeking its understanding, its wisdom. Here we are, back to a kind of maybe time for integrated understanding. Question of being ready for the logos out of the love relationship is, and we'll wonder if we, it does seem to me extraordinary that Io shows us how to stay with this relationship long enough or through its dark side, long enough to see one's way to Dodona, to see one's way to a place of understanding or a place of oracle. And of course, there are no hard and fast rules on what that takes or how long that is. But she has really carried the love of Zeus, just as she still carries her connection to Hera. And both feel like they're in a dark place.
Is there a sense that she's choosing to go to this oracle, or is it that she's wandering and here she is at the oracle?
Well, that's what I was asking. What would you say?
I don't know. That's why I asked.
Yes. See
this?
And you can feel the real liberation. I mean, there is a real feeling of sense, clear existential sense of liberation to move on. Then again, it may be constellated again, a new tethering. Sometimes the tethering is a new covenant in life or a new undertaking that really binds one to the ground and to a limited place. And then that may generate its own Argus. But I don't think one continually repeats precisely. If one learns something, maybe that's an optimistic idea. Hopefully we go up a slight spiral.
I think
How strange that such a crucial love relationship as she's had with Zeus should generate singleness, departure, solitude, wandering. It is as if the initiation by Aphrodite and Zeus prepares one for a very fertile autonomy. This is individuation in one of its essential stages. So the purpose, what are we saying? The purpose of the initiation of Eros love on the soul journey or on psyche's journey, interior psyche's journey, the purpose, if one can speak of purpose, there should be a better word, brings us towards an autonomy, brings us towards the individual, the making of the individual, so that there are these conditions of solitude, wandering, and darkness too. So, we regress to a simple natural state. That's one way to think about the cow. We regress to a simple natural state, a new beginning for the new beginning. And then move towards a wisdom that is face to face, not secondhand. Face to face at Dodona and her second oracle, Caucasus, at Caucasus. These are face-to-face encounters. This is like your description this morning, Bill, of standing before the god and asking the question, where you have the understanding. Now, I'd like to read the dialogue on the...
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.